It's been my lot before to speak on the Sunday morning after the meeting. And there's some disadvantages to that, and I suppose that's my reason for going ahead and taking this slot myself. I think we were all treated all week long to just fine lessons. And we took many tours through the Bible, so many references to Old and New Testament events that were brought to life in a great way, but more importantly, giving to us applications, things that would strengthen us and make us better and upbuild us. And really, in many ways, do the things we already know to do. I guess I'm convinced that if we all just knew all the, did all the things we knew to do, we'd be much better than we are. There may be some new things we all need to learn, but I suspect the bigger need is to be motivated to do the things that we're aware of that we need to do. And thanks to all from the ones who made the announcements or worked on the grounds, kept the building clean, prepared the song service, invited their friends, and of course to all that were here every night for supporting the meeting and making it such a good event. Tonight we'll have speaking for us Russ Hovater, Chad Ford, and George was going to speak to us, but he's having to go out of town. So Gary Copeland, who's conducting the Spanish-speaking meeting, which will be going on this morning after we're done, we may want to be careful about making too much noise as they complete their service. Those three men, Gary Copeland, Russ, and Chad, will speak to us this evening. We look forward to that. It's our fifth Sunday tradition. It's an opportunity, in some cases, to get to know new men. That's one way we've used it, men who come to us with some degree of experience, and also a way for us to develop the talent that we have here. So we'll look forward to that. You might want to be turning to Hebrews chapter 11. We'll look at that briefly. It's on page 810 in the Bible that you would find in the pew in front of you. As we've done this past week, we want to look at a character from out of the Old Testament. I don't believe David DeHartzell mentioned Gideon during his lessons this week, but that's what we're going to talk about this morning. And I know the children have been studying the Judges, and you know something about the story of Gideon. And we'll make some references to that this morning as we talk about it. But Gideon's mentioned by the Hebrew writer, a man writing to the Jews, probably in Jerusalem, to encourage them to be faithful and to hang on and to see the victory that's at the end. And in chapter 11, verse 32, he says, "What more shall I say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah and David and Samuel and the prophets, who, through faith..." Now, here are some things that I think could be said of Gideon. Notice how many of these kind of apply to Gideon. Subdued kingdoms in verse 33. Escaped the edge of the sword, we could say, in verse 34. Became valiant in battle. Turned to flight the armies of the aliens. That's probably the best one, isn't it? Because he surrounded them there in the night, scared them, and some of them killed each other, and the rest of them went tearing off across to the east, to the Jordan River. Many were killed there, and the rest of the Israelites ran them off, and they never came back again. And there was a period of 40 years peace at the end of that time. And so you're probably aware of the Gideon that the children's stories often cover. One is Gideon at night, worried about whether God is really going to do what he said. And he said, "I just have a request, and that is, let's have the dew be on the fleece only, but not the ground." And then the next night he said, "Well, you know, I can't remember which way it works anyway. Let's try the other way and make sure it's still the sign from God." And so it was on the ground and not the fleece. And we probably remember the blowing of the trumpet, with only 300 men surrounding that army that was at least 135, according to chapter 8, 135,000 men, and putting them to flight. And actually, in the end, probably destroying about 120,000, at least, of the soldiers. It's not clear that refers to one set of the kings of the Midianites, Amalekites, and children of the east that were banded together, but a lot of soldiers killed. What I want to talk about this morning, though, is really the story in between these two pictures, if you want to think about it. And that is, how could a man who's shown kneeling here, frightened in the night, be the same man who's blowing this trumpet at a great disadvantage and accomplishing some great victory? And really, the Hebrews writer kind of makes that very same point in that I skipped over one you probably noticed in verse 34. One of the things these men did through faith is that out of weakness, they were made strong. Out of weakness, they were made strong. And he says in chapter 12, he says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses..." And I believe these are witnesses that speak to us, not so much witnesses that watch us. They tell us, look what I did. Look what God did through me, through my faith. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us. And let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. We have a job to do. And these men stand as examples of how out of weakness they became strong. And so I'm interested in the story that goes between the first Gideon we see and the Gideon that then wins the great battle that results in the salvation of the Israelites from the Midianites. Now, how can this be relevant to us? I think as we go through life, there are challenges that are as big to us as taking 300 men and working to try to defeat the Midianites might have seemed to Gideon, especially given the way the story begins. Paul says, forgetting those things that are behind, I press on to think those things that are ahead. There are many things we have to overcome in life, and it might be a difficult family background and the influences on us. Paul says, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ loved the church. Peter says, husbands, dwell with your wives according to knowledge, giving honor to her as into the weaker vessel, that your prayers be not hindered. Paul says to the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians 7, that a wife, this is a commandment of the Lord, a wife is not to depart from her husband. Healing a broken marriage can be an enormous challenge that seems almost impossible. Jesus said, if you have a sacrifice and you have something between you and your brother, leave that sacrifice and go fix that. Go solve that relationship. Is that easy to do? Does it seem impossible? Something that's out of our reach? Paul also says in that 1 Corinthians letter, to be not unequally yoked to unbelievers. Maybe we're in a relationship that we have a lot of dependence on, but it's not right for us. It's sinful, or else it's a bad influence on us, and it needs to be changed. Provoke not your children to wrath, but nurture them in chastening and admonition of the Lord. What greater challenges could there be than a wayward child that we're aware of that needs to be turned back home? Let him that stole steal no more. Rather let him labor, working with his hands, that he may have thereof to give, whereof to give to him that hath need. And if any man provide not for his own, he's denied the faith and is worse than an infidel. There can be some deep problems that seem insurmountable that have to be solved. When for the time you ought to be teachers, you have need that someone teach you again of the oracles of the first principles of God. There are some who should be leaders, but how far away does that seem? How big of a challenge might it be? Shepherd the flock of God which is among you. Does that seem like a challenge to some? It is. And it could be that there are challenges to help people. As a husband or wife of someone who is struggling with these difficulties, that may seem just as big a challenge because of the love we have for those people. And it's in that context I want to study the story of Gideon. The first part of the story. Not the victory, but how he came from a position of fear, of disadvantage, where the challenge seemed almost impossible, and was able to succeed. The situation in Israel was this, and I'll try to give you a little bit of the map. It's not that essential for understanding everything in the story. This is the hometown of Gideon, Ophrah, a little village, and we're not really sure where it is. I suspect because it was so small. The battle took place for the most part up in this valley of Jezreel, and Gideon, the night before the battle, and his men were on Mount Gilboa, and they seemed to gather there, and that's where they all gathered, and then through this winnowing process eventually left and probably went down the backside. It's called Mount Gilead in the story, but they went down the backside of the mountain, perhaps to keep the host of the Midianites camped in that valley from knowing that they were all leaving. So maybe their expectations were that there were thousands of soldiers instead of just 300. But you can see the difficulty was that the Midianites with the Amalekites and children of the East would come in each year, probably around harvest time, the text seems to imply, and they would just take over everything. And they would take their animals and take their crops, so they didn't have anything. It says they were greatly impoverished in Judges chapter 6. By the way, if you want to now turn to Judges chapter 6 and 7, that's where our text will be the rest of the time. You'll find that on page 171 in the Bibles in front of you. So the children of the East would come over and pass the Jordan and then just basically plunder the land. And it says they even pass so far as Gaza, which is way down here. You see how far they moved down. But in this case, in this time where this battle occurs, they come up into the valley of Jezreel. When the story opens, they're not actually in the land yet. But after 40 years of peace, Israel had done evil in the sight of God. And as a result, there were 7 years of oppression, this alliance between Midian and these other nations. And the people, because of the fear of the Midianites, lived in caves. They had their crops taken, and they were very impoverished. And as a result of that, they cried to God. And you've studied the Judges, you know that's the cycle. And when they cried to God, what God did, in this case at least, was He sent a prophet. And the prophet speaks to them, and it's interesting what he says in chapter 6. The prophet comes to them, and I don't think I'll read this whole thing, even for the sake of time, but I do want you to notice something, how many quotation marks there are. I think I took some of them out when I pasted this into the text. But if you look in your Bible, by the time he gets to the end, there are 3 nested quotation marks, and I'll tell you why. The prophet is not saying anything new. The text is quoting the prophet is quoting God, and God's quoting himself what he said a long time ago, if that's the way, if you keep looking at it. He says, look, I brought you out of Egypt. I brought you out of the house of bondage. They know all that. There's nothing new in that story about Moses. In fact, Gideon kind of quotes that story later as if to say, I don't see any of that happening now. But he knew about it, and they were familiar with this. And he says, I said to you before, you see, and I said to you, he's reminding them of what he said before. This prophet is not foretelling the future. He's reminding them of what they already knew. And I think in our challenges in life, once again, it's things we already know, that we've done wrong, that we need to do right. We just need to be reminded of those things. And that's what this prophet supplies for these people. And I think that's the case with us as well. Gideon starts in his long journey. And I don't know if the outline shows up, but the path he's going to go through is in black, and we'll illuminate it as we go. But he starts off in suffering with the people of Israel. Gideon was the son of Joash, a small family, he says, the smallest in his tribe. Who was an Abiezrite, which must have been a subclan of the tribe of Manasseh. When the story opens, we find him in the wine press threshing wheat. Now, wheat and wine, that's not the same thing. Wine is pressed in a vat of some kind. So whether he was down in a hole or whether he was in some enclosure where there was a wall around him, that's where he was, but he was threshing wheat. And you can just imagine him down in there looking around to see if the Midianites were coming. Why was he down in the hole? Down in the wine press, because he was afraid. It says he was afraid of the Midianites. He was trying to protect his crops, and if they showed up out of nowhere, at least he could maybe cover up the wheat that he had, the small bit of grain, and protect that. Not a courageous sight, actually, down in the wine press. Later on, we'll see in his discussion with the angel, maybe he moves out of that position, but in any case, that's where we find him. And he's suffering with the children of Israel. He's in a low state. I think sometimes that's important for us too. And maybe God sends us that as a result of our sins. If you go back to this previous chart that we looked at, if you look at many of these things in this list of challenges that we have, a lot of these are the result of sin. Oftentimes our own or the sins of others. And I think that that we often get to suffer, and it helps bring us to our senses. And maybe it also lets us then hear these words that are spoken to us that we've always heard all our life, and we're reminded of that because of the situation that we're in. And then an angel appears. And you can read about that in chapter 6 and about verse 12. And I'll just kind of summarize what the angel says. The first thing he says is, "The Lord is with you, mighty man of valor." Find that in about verse 12. That's an interesting introduction. Now, I kind of earlier used to picture this, that the angel maybe came over and looked down into that wine press or came right up to the edge. But it says the angel sat under the terebinth tree. And so I picture something like this. The angel sits over here, and Gideon, of course, remember Gideon, he's over here down in the wine press. And it's interesting, I don't think Gideon knows who it is. There's just voice that comes out and says, "The Lord is with you, O mighty man of valor." Later in verse 14, he says, "You shall save Israel. Go in this might of yours, you shall save Israel from the hand of Midian. Have I not sent you?" And he also gives Gideon a vision of what he is about to do. He says, "Surely I will be with you. You shall defeat the Midianites as one man." So there's this call. And what the angel is doing, basically, is showing Gideon that out there, somehow, some way, this great thing is going to happen. It's going to be done. And despite where you are right now, There's a vision of victory that he gives him. Now, what's between? Lots of things. A long way to go. But at least he gives him a vision of victory. The first thing that happened is that Gideon doubts. And you can see that in this conversation. I think I got the signal that I can't wander around from the mic. So I'll try not to act any more parts out. I'd like to look at this conversation again in a little more detail. Verse 11, the angel of the Lord came and sat under the terebinth tree which was in Ophrah, which belonged to Joash the Abiezrite, while his son Gideon threshed out wheat in the winepress in order to hide it from the Midianites. The angel of the Lord appeared to him and said, "The Lord is with you, you mighty man of valor." And Gideon said to him, by the way, this says, "Oh my Lord," in the New King James. But there's a footnote, if you have one, that kind of suggests that this is not "my Lord" like the Lord Jehovah or the Lord God. This is just like, "Hey, mister," or "sir." You know, that's the intent of that. And you'll see this, the address with which Gideon addresses this angel of Jehovah changes as the story progresses. But Gideon basically says, "I'm sorry, sir. If the Lord is with us, why then has all this happened to us? And where are all his miracles which our fathers told us about, saying, 'Did not the Lord bring us out of Egypt?' But now the Lord has forsaken us and delivered us into the hands of Midianites." This is not the picture of a courageous, faithful man. He's actually questioning those stories about God delivering Israel, it seems to me. If he's with us, why is all this happening to me? And I think sometimes as we look at these challenges in our lives, it's easy for us to say somehow God's just left us. But the truth is there's a vision of victory still out there. Verse 14, then the Lord turned, which I suggest means that the angel kind of got up and maybe he got a better look at him as a result of that. The Lord turned to him and said, "Go in this might of yours, and you shall save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have I not sent you?" And now Gideon has a little different attitude. He says, "Oh my Lord," different word this time. This is the one for Jehovah. "How can I save Israel? Indeed, my clan is the weakest in Manasseh, and I am the least in my father's house." So he begins to make excuses, similar to Moses and others, but he has this weak view of himself. And finally, verse 16, the Lord said to him, "Surely I will be with you, and you shall defeat the Midianites as one man." And so Gideon is left with this dilemma. Does he accept that or not? And what he does is he addresses these doubts, which he's expressed before. I think he understood that he was talking to an angel of the Lord. And he says, "Look, could you prove that it's really you?" That's the way it actually reads. Is this really you? You know who you is that I'm talking to. And I suspect that at first he had no idea. And finally he started to think, this could be Jehovah that I'm speaking with here. And he needed a confirmation of that. And so what happened was, God actually gave him a confirmation. What happened, Gideon went and prepared a gift, which is fairly expensive, I would think, especially in the impoverished state. He took one of his goats and killed it, offered it, cooked it. He took bread, which is made from that wheat that he's threshing in the winepress. He made cakes. He brought them out. The angel said, "Lay them on the rock," and he did. And he said, "Pour the broth out on it." And fire came up out of the rock and consumed those things. When he saw that, Gideon said, "That's it, I've seen the angel of the Lord." And he reacted a little bit like Samson's parents and some others who figured they were about to die because of their close association with God, having seen the angel of the Lord. There's something a little illogical about that. If God's just promised you're going to go lead the people to defeat Midian, and then you decide you're about to die because you've seen him. But anyway, Gideon was impressed. And as a result of that, his doubts were taken away. And as a result, he built an offer and named it after what the angel said, which was peace. You're not going to die. And so Gideon built an altar, and he named it Jehovah is Peace. So God confirmed that he was who he was, and that he said was going to happen was going to happen. Now that very same night, God's voice spoke to Gideon again. But he didn't say, "Go get an army together. It's time to start making swords and weapons." He made an interesting instruction to Gideon. He said, "Tear down the altar which is in your father's house," the altar to Baal. And apparently a Baal altar and the wooden image of the Asherah, the female counterpart, was right there in Gideon's house. And supported by his father, and apparently maybe had some prominence in the village because of the reaction of those men of the village when he tore it down.
Now, I don't know if he did it that night, but he did it at night. And that is, he went and he tore the altar down. He gathered some of his servants together, and it says he went at night so that he wouldn't be detected, although he was afraid of the men of the city, verse 27. But he did it. God's instructions were to take the second bull, tear down the altar, kill the bull, sacrifice it on the altar, and use the wood of the torn down altar as a way to make the burnt offering. And he did that. And of course, immediately there was opposition. Now, I would just say that as we look forward to our challenges, there are probably some things that we could fix within ourselves that may seem unrelated to our challenge that we're trying to meet downstream, that have to do with what we need to fix about ourselves within our own house, to get our own house in order. When we begin to take any action toward God, we're going to meet opposition. But the rest of the story is that he finds supporters, surprisingly, in his own dad. The men of the city come the next morning, and the language implies that the altar and the sacrifice is still burning, still smoldering. And they say, well, who's done this? We're going to kill him. We need to kill him. Gideon's done it. Bring him out. We need to kill him for doing this to our altar. And his dad stands up for him and says, look, if Baal's really a god, let him contend. And the result of that was Gideon got a name called Jerubbaal, which means let Baal contend, which he carried around really through the rest of the story as a kind of a signpost for everyone to say, I represent the fact that Baal is no god. And as long as I'm alive, it's clear that Baal has not taken vengeance to me for what he's done. And so he stood for truth, and he carried that around in a public way, and he gained support from someone in his own family. And so that beginning obedience, while it seemed irrelevant, was needed to clean out his own house, to stand as truth before others, to gain supporters in the effort that he was about to go after. Almost immediately, at least as far as the story reads, in verse 33, the Midianites, the Amalekites, the people of the east gathered together. They crossed over and camped in the valley of Jezreel. A crisis arrives. I think when we've resolved to fix a problem, sometimes it's up to us to go ahead and take the first step, but sometimes it's also the case that it just happens. It comes right there. This person we need to be reconciled with, this relationship we need to break off, this relationship we need to heal, the opportunity suddenly is there. Are we prepared for it? Are we prepared for what we're supposed to do according to God's command when that occurs? Well, Gideon was. And he blew the trumpet, and he called the Abiezrites, verse 34. He sent messengers throughout all of Manasseh, and he gathered together others that were available from the other tribes, Asher, Zebulun, and Naphtali, and they came up to meet him. So now he's got this huge crowd of people. I think it turns out to be about 33,000 by the time they all get together. But they're facing, of course, 135,000 fighting men, and maybe others, maybe even more than that in terms of fighting men. So there's a sense that he has taken the first step. He's committed himself now to be the leader in that he's gathered them all together. But I sense some anxiety now because he's got a couple of nights, maybe before they all gather together, maybe before he has his opening address, and he starts to worry. And he has some uncertainty. In verse 36, he says to God, If you will save Israel by my hand, as you have said, then I'll put this fleece of wool on the threshing floor. And those of you that studied the story know that this is what he was trying to do, was to just get some confirmation that God really was with him. So he says, let's put the fleece out. And sure enough, the dew was on the fleece and not the ground. Then he thought, well, let's do it again. And he almost apologizes for that. Verse 39, do not be angry with me. Let me speak just once more. Let me test, I pray, just once more with the fleece. And then he reverses the test. And of course, God does as he commands, or as he requests. And so God reassures Gideon in giving him, he actually accommodates his request for a sign. And as a result of that, chapter 7 and verse 1, it says that Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the well of Herod. So the camp of the Midianites was on the north side of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. Now to picture this, if you can remember the map, let's figure Mount Gilboa, and then there's a little hill, and then there's this huge valley up there. And in that valley is where all the Midianites are. So they're somewhat within sight of the Midianites, and perhaps the Midianites are aware of the gathering of those great numbers of people from out of Israel. But what God asked him to do in his commitment is to reduce the size of his army. And the first thing he does, which is actually what the law requires in Deuteronomy chapter 20 and verse 8, he said, anybody that's afraid, go home. And there were some that were afraid. In fact, I guess 23,000 were afraid. He ends up with 10,000. I'm sorry, 10,000 remain, verse 3. But God says again in verse 4, these are too many. So he brings them down to the water. And you know that part of the story. Those that drank the water in a certain way, for whatever reason, that was the selection process. Could be that it was just a smaller number, but it was 300 people, and that was it. That was all that was left. And the other people left, and the language kind of implies that maybe they wound around back behind the mountain so that their leaving wouldn't quite be as detectable by the Midianites, and they left their stuff behind. I guess that's where they got all the trumpets and the pots and the torches, you know, that they were going to use in the night. But they all left in verse 5. They sent away all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, and retained those 300. And now you can kind of sense the tension, because it's time. It's the very night in which all of this is going to kind of come to a head. And the language is interesting in verse 8, the last sentence in verse 8 of chapter 7. Now the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. It's night. Can you imagine what that looked like? It says that the number of the Midianites were like locusts, or like the sands of the sea, and camels without number. I tried to work on a little picture of what that might look like, you know, but if you've ever been up on one of those mountains, looking over the Jezreel Valley, you can see a long way. And I imagine the air was clearer then than it is now. But imagine all those campfires, you know, twinkling out way off, way to the mountain ridge on the other side. And Gideon's up high where he can see this great number of the enemy. And it actually goes into some detail in verse 12. The Midianites and Amalekites, the people of the east, were lying in the valley as numerous as locusts. Their camels were without number, as the sand by the seashore in multitude. And guess what? Gideon's afraid. After all this, after two signs, after all that he's accomplished, well, what has he really accomplished so far? He's just winnowed out his force down to 300 men. And God says, verse 9, arise, go down against the camp. I have delivered it into your hand. God always speaks kind of like it's already happened. That's an interesting thing. We don't see time that way, but to him it's already happened. But he says in verse 10, and this is amazing to me, not because God knew he was afraid, but he just continues to accommodate Gideon's weakness and his fears. But if you are afraid, go down. If you're afraid to go down to the camp with Purah your servant. You shall hear what they say, and afterwards your hand shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. And so, as if to say, yes, I am afraid. He said, if you're afraid, go down. And he went down. He took his servant down. And I guess they crept up on some of the tents, and they overheard a man saying that he'd had a dream, and it was a barley loaf that had rolled in and knocked the tent over. And the man, part of the Midianites, interpreted that, and he said, I know what this is. This is all about Gideon. He's going to come and take us and drive us away. Is that a miracle? Was that a miracle that happened? One thing I want to point out is if you look across the top row of this chart, these are the things that God did to answer these problems that Gideon had, these weaknesses that he had. Confirmation, in that he just, you know, took the fire from the rock and destroyed that sacrifice. And then the fleece incident with reassurance. And now this vision or this dream that Gideon overhears. Do you notice that they get lesser and lesser? I mean, to some extent, fire consuming the food would be more impressive to me than the fleece on the, you know, dew on the fleece. At the same time, overhearing someone saying, I had a dream last night, and I'm not sure that's a miracle at all. Maybe God worked events where he started to worry about it because he had heard about the Israelites gathering, and that's what he dreamed about, and that's the dream he had. And maybe a lot of people had that dream. And in the darkness, it was a little spooky, and so he began to be worried about it. And I don't know if there's a miracle there or not. I guess I would point out that as Gideon gets closer and closer to the real crisis, the need for courage, his need for confirmation seems to get a little bit less. These are lesser signs as we go forward. And so God leads Gideon to a vision of victory again, even spoken by those of the enemy. And so Gideon takes action. And he went that very night, and he took 100 men, and he split the other 200 into groups of 100, and they surrounded the camp, and I guess they hid their torches in the pottery, and then suddenly exposed them, blew the trumpet, shouted for Jehovah and for Gideon, and frightened the Midianites, so that in the end, that great, bloody, you know, scary battle almost took care of itself. They'd killed themselves, and they took off running, and the rest of Israel kind of came down and finished the battle for him. The problems he had later settling the squabbles among the Israelites seemed to me were tougher than the battle turned out to be before it was all over. And I think a lot of times the things that we most fear when we finally face them, we finally make the decision that we have to make to reconcile, to ask for forgiveness, to break off a relationship, to go and speak to that person that needs to be spoken to. How does it actually turn out? Is it as frightening as we always thought it would be? Usually not. Usually it kind of almost takes care of itself. It's the unexpected things, I think, sometimes that are more frightening to us. And so the result of that was victory. I guess I would ask this question as we kind of try to come to some applications. What did God do for Gideon? Did he bring an angel and kill all the armies? That happened in Hezekiah's day, but didn't happen here. Did he part the Red Sea and then bring it back in on the enemies? Well, no, that happened another time, but not here. You know, really the book of Judges doesn't have many miracles. And all the miracles in this story have to do with convincing Gideon to do what he should do and really not accomplishing the work God had for Gideon to do. What he did do for Gideon is, I think he allowed him to suffer. That's a lesson for us. When we're suffering, it's a wake-up call. It may mean we need to fix something. We need to fix our own house. And he called him to great accomplishments, just as he calls us to be more than we are. When Gideon had doubts, he provided answers. He called him to specific and immediate action. He says, you know, there's a problem in your father's house. Fix that tonight. And he did. He provided reassurance when he was doubtful or insecure or frightened. And he guided the events as Gideon obeyed. And I think that's the important part for us. It's our job to do what God says is right to do and let God work out the details and the results and the consequences, good or bad, as we see them. And he may ask us to do some strange things, like go on with 300 men instead of several hundred thousand men. What did Gideon do for himself? Well, he heard the call, and he did change a lot from that first vision we had of him, frightened down in the wine press, and almost irreligious and almost having lost faith in the God that had delivered the Israelites out of the Egyptian bondage. And he sought answers. When he had a doubt, he just went to God or someplace where he could find the answers and sought those answers. I think sometimes we're reluctant to do that. It's more comfortable just to say, well, I have some doubts. That's what's holding me back. What are we doing to address those? Who have you asked about it? What books have you bought to read about it? What Bible study have you engaged in to try to resolve those doubts? And Gideon wasn't shy about asking for confirmation. He got his own house in order first. He acknowledged his insecurities and fears and sought help. And he obeyed at each step. Ultimately, whenever God told him directly to do something, he did it. Even when, perhaps, he might have chosen a different path or more men or some other way of doing things. Remember our challenges? Have you picked one out as we've gone through that you've maybe thought about as we've looked at the lesson of Gideon and how he, from weakness, was made strong? Maybe you've picked one out. Here's what we need to do. Hear the call. I read some verses at the beginning of the lesson, which I think are a call from God to do what we're supposed to do. We need to hear that call. Now, that may seem so impossible to us. It might seem as impossible as taking care of the Midianites did to Gideon when he first was down treading out the wheat. If you have doubts or insecurities or we're not sure that's really what God's telling us to do, we need to seek answers for those. And there are many resources for that. That's why we meet together, to teach and admonish one another, to provoke one another to love and good works. That's where the answers are. It isn't found in being on our own or missing services or being away from where Christians are. There are probably things in whatever this crisis is that you maybe have chosen to think about that need to be done within our own lives. I think sometimes about struggles to improve the faithfulness of other Christians, to prepare a relationship. And the people involved in that are not even regular in attendance, or they're not really devoted themselves, or they have a bad habit that stands out as a source of criticism. It's going to make it very tough to do the things to reconcile with someone or to stand up for the truth in that challenging situation if we have things wrong that are obviously wrong in our own life, in our own relationship. There are things we can fix about ourselves, habits that we can set. And when that happens, I believe what we'll do is we'll get support and we'll make a name for ourselves, like Gideon did with the name Jerubbaal. People will see that change and they'll say, what's going on? And it becomes a testimony to the sincerity of what we're trying to accomplish. If we're trying to lead someone in a problem or reconcile a relationship or repair a marriage, it'll stand out as our devotedness, as the basis for what we're trying to do. And finally, we need to obey at each step, even when we don't understand. If you're not a Christian, God has called you to something more spectacular than any victory that could be accomplished on this earth. You need to hear His call. He calls you to confess that Jesus is the Son of God, to repent of your sins, and to be baptized for the remission of those sins. And you can do that today. If you have doubts or you don't understand what God wants you to do, seek answers. And there are people here who can help you find those answers. And this is the first step to getting your own house in order. Take advantage of the great blessing and the great victory that waits at the end of the way for all of us. If you need to respond in a public way, we'd encourage you to come as we stand and sing.